Welcome to the Floor Specifier Podcast. I am one of your hosts, Brett Cyphers. My hosting partner, Ryan Matthews, unfortunately can't be with me for this one, but that's okay because this is a short intro to the other podcast that we do under the Florida Specifier bandwagon. Keep in mind that this podcast was recorded in a large auditorium. The audio is a little bit off, a little different than you're probably used to from the show being done in a studio atmosphere, but we think that you will enjoy the content anyway. It's from the One Water Summit that was held recently in Winter Haven by the One Water Commission and its director, Gary Hubbard. And so thank you to that board and that group for putting this on. I hope you enjoy the show.
Today is November 18th for those of you listening in your car or at home, and I'm pleased to be recording the show in front of an audience here at the One Water Summit in Winter Haven. So before I introduce this phenomenal group of conversation partners, I first want to thank Gary Hubbard and former Water for Fighting guest Eric Draper for agreeing to this atypical discussion format. I also want to thank my sponsors. Water for Fighting is a product of Florida Specifier Media, and it's made possible by the generosity of Resource Environmental Solutions, or RES, and Sea and Shoreline. More on them later. Okay, enough of the throat clearing. Let's get right to it. One of my conversation partners today is Lynn Spivey, right next to me. Lynn is the Director of Utilities for the City of Plant City, and she has over three decades of experience in various areas related to water management, water and wastewater treatment, and potable reuse. She holds a bachelor's degree in chemical engineering from the University of South Florida. Lynn is also the past president of Water Reuse Florida, chairwoman of the Florida Potable Reuse Commission, and is the Florida Water Environment Association's past director at large. Next, we have David McIntyre. David is the president of Aqua SciTech Consulting, and he too brings decades of experience working throughout the world, offering his water resource expertise to a vast array of clients. He holds a bachelor's degree in civil engineering from the University of Cambridge and a master's in environmental engineering from the University of Florida. And finally, we have Frank Bernardino, who I've managed to draw out of semi to mostly retired status to join us today. Frank is partner emeritus, if that's an actual thing, it is, for us anyway, at my very own Anfield Consulting, and he's even a former guest of Water for Fighting. More importantly, like Lynn and David, Frank has over three decades experience working on water and natural resources management issues throughout Florida. He holds a BS degree in environmental studies and a master's degree in biology, both from Florida International University. He's widely recognized as one of the most effective environmental lobbyists in Tallahassee, and I'm fortunate enough to call him my friend. All right, we have some responsibilities here on the syllabus to cover regulatory funding and communications challenges that Florida's utilities, professionals, and advocates face and moving One Water forward as a coherent and, more importantly, persuasive movement. For those of you that listened to my podcast before, you know how this is going to go at the beginning here. It's very biographical in nature and personality-driven, and I'm a big believer that people's motivations and the experiences they draw from are at least as important as often their expertise is, especially when you're talking about moving public policy. So we're going to spend just a few minutes on each of them individually. Lynn, let's start with you. Where are you from? How'd you get to Plant City? And why are you involved in One Water?
Thank you, Brett. So I'm originally from Brooklyn, New York. I don't tell too many people that. But came to Florida when I was 17. Spent a bunch of time, over 20 years, in the private consulting arena. And then came to Plant City when the opportunity presented itself. I wasn't really looking to jump to the public side, but did work as a consulting engineer in Plant City. Loved it. Thought it had a great team. Thought it would be awesome to work with Patrick Murphy. So I came to Plant City, and it was a great move. So why am I involved with One Water? I think I've always liked collaborative approaches. One thing I liked consulting arena was really team building and that kind of think tank approach. And to me, that's what One Water is. It's really a very collaborative, integrated think tank of how to think of our water resources. So that's how I came to One Water.
David, let's go to you next. Going to take a wild guess that you might not be a native Floridian as well. So where are you from, and how do we get the benefit of your presence today?
I was born in Scotland and had most of my schooling there. My parents moved out to the Middle East. My dad was working there. And so from 10 to 18 years old, I shuttled between school in Scotland and family in the Middle East. Took a bachelor's degree in civil engineering at Cambridge. Realized the single most important thing I learned was, this isn't what I want to do. What I was really interested in my life, I realized, was I like the interaction between what we do as human beings and how that affects the natural world. And so an interest in pursuing that. At that time, the U.S. was preeminently the strongest place to go for that, and I ended up coming to the University of Florida. Never regretted that. It's formed the arc of my life. At Florida, I got very interested in water resources generally, but particularly in groundwater. I hadn't originally intended to stay in the States at all. I was thinking international work, but I found I loved it here, and especially if you're interested in groundwater, I don't think there's a better place in the world to practice interesting work in groundwater than in Florida. Interest in surface water too, and of course the two are very, very closely related here in this state. And over time I also became very, very interested in what do we do with reclaimed water and how does that fit the pattern of water supply generally. And that's really what drew me into integrated water supply planning and one water approaches.
And what types of projects has that taken you toward? Like, what is your general focus? You and I just met, you know, really, as we're getting ready to do this podcast, Elena's got to be in charge of a utility. We'll get to what her life is like with the constraints that we have on her. But for you, it's like, what types of projects do you typically work on?
Well, I'm a consultant, so the bulk of my practice is with municipal utilities here in Florida. I've done projects, as you mentioned earlier, all over the world, but the bulk of my practice has been Florida generated, and I typically work on water supply planning and permitting projects, and likewise reclaimed water planning, design, permitting projects, and in particular a focus on, if we're going to use reclaimed water when there isn't enough irrigation demand for it, what do you do with it during those wet periods, or if you just in general don't have enough other alternative use for it, to treat it as something useful to be brought back into the hydrologic cycle, as opposed to a waste product we try to get rid of someplace where it's largely non-beneficial.
I think we'll be getting into more of that in just a couple minutes or so. Let's finish the introduction with, last but not least, Frank. People can listen to your episode of the show if they want to get the entire rundown of your life. And for the record, we talked for about 2.5 hours and had to cut at least an hour because he has some opinions on the nature of free agency and the NFL and et cetera, et cetera. So we didn't keep all of it. But maybe give us, for today, the nickel tour. And more importantly, I want you to touch on what's so important about this discussion that you would agree to be here today.
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you to Gary for all of your hard work and pulling this together. I know it's been a labor of love for you and something you've been working on for a very long time. So by way of background, I began my career in natural resources as a research assistant in Everglades National Park when I was 18 years old. So I've been working in the environment in Florida for 42 years. And I'm that person who, as a number of you who know me really well in the audience know, I have a hard time keeping my mouth shut and not putting my opinion out there. So that hour that he cut off the tape is all the things he didn't want people to hear about my very strong opinions. But the perfect example, and it'll take you why I thought that this was a worthwhile exercise to come down to. One of my career experiences was way back during the Bush administration, sitting in a meeting. At the time, I was one of the lobbyists for the South Florida Water Management District, and the executive directors and the chair of the boards get together with the secretary ever so often to talk about Florida and where we're going and what we need to do. And they work their way around the room talking about priorities. Totally unprompted, I interrupted the secretary when she was speaking, Colleen Castile, and I just went, blah, 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 blah. Do you people hear yourselves? I mean, for all of these great ideas that you have, how are you going to get there? And I've always been fascinated, and as a lobbyist for the last 30 years representing local governments and the private sector, what excited me about the job, because I am retired, newly retired, was the puzzle aspect of it. Finding either institutional or other various regulatory barriers and finding the solutions and the way through it. And I think so much of what One Water is going to be about going forward is going to be identifying regulatory, institutional, financial obstacles and working your way through it. And I think that there's some really great opportunities And I hope we'll dive into some of those during our discussion today.
So let's start with a baseline in terms of definitions. What is One Water from your perspective? Let's start with you, Lynn.
So I'll tell you how I thought of water before. The first time that I started becoming fascinated with water is when I broke into a water treatment plant that was at the end of our development, just had to know what was in there. And the operator there started talking about when I thought, oh my God, these are big giant pools of poop water. And he started talking about water, and it was really quite fascinating from the aspect of water is water, and then a lot of stuff happens to it. It has experiences and journeys. So I think back to that now, that's really my first real understanding of One Water. Water is just water, and it has a journey, and has a lot of experiences, and things happen to it, but it's always water, and we could take it back to that state. When I started looking at the definitions of One Water, because now you could actually find a lot of definitions for One Water, even just a year, 2 years ago, you couldn't. You looked it up and it wasn't a lot out there. But there's a lot of definitions of it. They're all confusing and they all don't tell you anything. So when we think about how we're explaining One Water to the general public, it's really confusing. So I'm just gonna read One Water just for a few minutes. Holistic approach to water that says all water sources as value and are interconnected. That was one of them. That was a wiki one. Here's another wiki one. The management of all water sources in an integrated and sustainable way, considering all water sources and uses the principle of providing affordable water access for everyone. I actually wouldn't agree with that one at all. Then the Water Research Foundation says an integrated planning and implementation approach to managing finite water resources, it gets a little bit more detailed, for long-term resiliency and reliability. So I think that's meeting the mark a little more. Then the U.S. Water Alliance, One Water is a transformative way of viewing, valuing, and managing water. The One Water approach manages all water, whether from tap, a stream, stormwater, blah, blah, blah. Inclusive, holistic manner. I think this last sentence is kind of interesting. One Water can change and regenerate the way we live, the opportunities we have, and our environment and our society. And I think that kind of hits it, the last line.
Well, if I'm nothing, I'm a contrarian. And so I want to go back to when you said you don't like that definition. I didn't catch that part. You said they said something and I don't agree with it. I want to hear what that is again. I want to hear why you don't agree with that definition necessarily. Is that all right? Is that an unfair question to ask you to go back? Okay.
Well, I'll ask everybody, are we really tackling water resources to make sure that the general public has low-cost water? No, that's not how we're thinking at all. So I think One Water is talking about having more of a dialogue with the end user so that they better understand the journey and the cost of the journey. But no, I don't think that's it. Should it be our goal? Perhaps. When I read that, I thought, oh, that should be our goal, but it's not.
Hmm. Yeah, and I think to that point, if that was your driver, you wouldn't get out of the first base.
Right.
I can't tell you how many times I've had meetings with a county administrator or a county commissioner, and they're like, well, if this is going to increase the prices, we're not going to do it. And it's like, well, you need to do it. You're not going to have flood control. You're not going to have water supply if you don't do it. But I don't think that most water practitioners have that as a driving point, so I would agree with you.
I think that we do ultimately look at it as what's the most cost-effective way to attack this problem as an engineer. That's almost always part of our thought process. But we're doing it in a larger context of a series of constraints and objectives that we have to achieve. And then it's okay if I can achieve all of that now. Is this a reasonably cost-effective way to do it? The other thing I think we wrestle with is lifetime cost accounting. So much of what we do, we look at a portion of a problem and say, I can optimize that, and I can optimize the cost effectiveness of that, but we're not actually looking at total life cycle costs for the whole system. And so you may optimize your water supply individually and then come over to your wastewater plant and optimize what you do there individually. The combined effects could have been used synergistically to lower cost overall for the entire operation, but it's only recently we're starting to look at things that way.
Yeah, I think it's a good place to a little bit more level setting, because we're in a very water resource constrained area here, dead inside of the CFWI. So we're dealing with water quantity issues specifically. But if you look more broadly, and I think a lot of people covered it, I think Tabitha's map was like pretty descriptive, you know, in terms of water quality issues as well. And so as a predicate for moving forward, I want to offer a thought that a friend of Frank and mine, a partner of ours, and I think other folks here, and she said that when we were talking about it originally, the four of us, she said, Florida is a place where the desire to do good abounds. We lose a lot in execution. And I think you, all three of you, just started to kind of edge into that territory, you know, feet first. But to what extent do you agree with the first part of that equation, which is, it seems to me that it's not a malevolence that is driving the desire for clean water and wetland survival and you know, and these sorts of things. So capture that first part, but also the, you know, the part where the execution, is it simply a matter of execution? And David, you have the slice going on right now, so why don't you take that one first?
Good, I'm so glad you're going first.
Not fair.
We turned our microphones off when we started talking about this.
First of all, intent. I think there is a great deal of goodwill, particularly amongst those who are in the industry, that by and large, there aren't that many people out there that I would view as wearing black hats. Objectives do diverge, however, and we have to try and find common ground. Beyond that, I think it's more a culture of not being aware that water, by and large, is fit, and particularly water infrastructure, tends to be more or less invisible to us. The pipes are buried, the plants are tucked away to make them as unobtrusive as possible. And really, for most people, their experience of water is either I turn on the tap and I'm either happy or not happy with what comes out of it, or something in the natural world that I don't see as being connected to that water supply in my vision of the world. That's where I think in order to get a groundswell of broader public support for the need that we're talking about here, we need to break through that wall and have a much greater awareness amongst the people who ultimately have to pay the bills for this as to why. What's this for? What do you get for it? Why does it cost what it's going to cost?
I would agree. I think the biggest frustration that I have, having attended many, many water conferences and forums in Florida over the 40-some years, including the Water Congress, for anybody who may have been around or remember, I don't know, was it, Eric, 20 years ago, we sat down and it was going to be the end-all, be-all, and all the sectors were there, and they took 2 days in Orlando, and they brought us out, and there were delegates, and my God, we were just going to rewrite the water world, and, you know, it literally went nowhere after all that momentum. Nothing happened. I don't think that the issue in Florida is the lack of good intent, but what I find is that we're constantly in an echo chamber where all of us who think alike and for the most part have the same mindset sit and talk to each other, and the message doesn't make its way out to the people who really have the ultimate responsibility to make a difference. And the kind of thing that probably would have got me edited in the first podcast, but hopefully won't on this one, is I find that there's a lack of courage, oftentimes, among policymakers to make the really difficult decisions, to do the things that need to get done in order to implement these wonderful ideas. There's always an impediment. There's always a reason why not. Now is not the time. We've got other priorities, and we seem to stumble getting out of the gate. And so to me, it isn't, again, the lack of among us in the room all agreeing on what we want to do. It's as you suggested. How do we convince the public? It's the one group that they will listen to is the public. And if the public demands in a large enough voice that something happen, the policymakers will make it happen.
You're right on, you're talking to, and yeah, I'm going to cut all of this. No, I'm kidding. It is until it isn't, right? With your customers, with the ratepayers, with the taxpayers. And so, and we'll get to some of that bridging that gap in terms of messaging. But let's start with being very specific, because when we're going to get down to these parts we're talking about communicating, they want specificity and points where they need to act, knowing that they're then going to have the backing of their own constituencies. And that could be, you know, local, regional, or state. But we can't limit ourselves to the things in front of us. And so, Lynn, you spent more time than the rest at the business end of what that is. So let's be a little bit specific in terms of, let's give ourselves examples, perhaps. And I'm thinking you and David specifically, which is, we say that we have this problem where from a regulatory standpoint, we have these disconnects. Let's describe the disconnects first, if we can, and then we'll move to, you know, what does one do about it?
So I think part of the disconnects are maybe everybody wants to do good, but doing good has different definitions in different factions. So, and we're not on the same page on what that good is. So there's a lot of breakdown. We speak our own language, and that's been a problem forever. I think we're trying to bridge the gap of the language by hiring people who can actually interpret for us. And we're seeing that public education and outreach everywhere. We're reaching out to be better communicators to the public. But I think in Florida right now, there's a real divergence on what we need and what's good for the state. We have a real growth spurt, and I think our elected officials from the local government up see their job as growing the state, and we're trying to provide water for it, good water, and that's not being talked about in conjunction. Matter of fact, if one costs the other some money, then you start splitting. So I think that we're not on the same page about our goals. We don't have the same language. The list goes on from there. So how do you start the conversation? And again, we are a ratepayer fund, so we're very limited. And I'm constantly being told your local government should do better. So how much can we really put on the backs of our ratepayers? You know, for these crazy costs that we have just to do rehab and rehabilitation, let alone being progressive and doing things for the future. It's not an equation that we really can figure out, so I don't know how to progress this dialogue anymore. You know, it's a little here, a little there. I don't know. Frank? David?
One of the things I find wrestling is especially difficult is when benefits and costs don't accrue to the same place. The people who end up bearing the cost are not necessarily the same folks who are gaining the benefit. It's extremely difficult to get people to buy into that as a problem.
Can you give an example of that, Dave?
If you take an example of, for instance, cooperation between multiple cities, in many cases, water supply is constrained by lake level, say, in a minimum flows and levels lake. One city might have territory right next to the lake and an area that's suitable for aquifer recharge. We can mitigate the impacts to the lake of drawdown for surrounding cities. That's a cost to the city that does the mitigation. The benefit accrues to a bunch of surrounding communities. Getting to a point of partnership between those communities where everyone's willing to say, okay, I'm getting enough out of this and to be worth what I'm putting into it, that's tough. It's difficult to get to that.
Let's take a minute to talk about my friends at Resource Environmental Solutions. Our state presents unique challenges with its diverse ecosystems, landscapes, and the many demands on its natural resources. That's why RES uses an innovative approach and creative solutions to help municipalities, agencies, and local water resource groups navigate the ever-changing landscape of environmental regulations in Florida and throughout the country. RES actively restores habitats, hydrological regimes, and ecosystem functions across Florida, from the Panhandle to the Heartland, to the Florida Keys and everywhere in between. They focus on restoring floodplains and wetlands and improving water quality, which benefits a wide array of species that call Florida home. With an unwavering commitment to Florida's unique ecological communities, RES upholds long-term stewardship practices, guaranteeing sustainable outcomes that endure. Discover more about their work and commitment to Florida's communities and the environmental challenges they face by visiting www.res.us. All right, now back to the conversation.
How much effort is being put into making those connections between communities at a local level? So when you're looking at some of these trade-offs that you know, you're looking at your clients, David, what are some of those and how much work is going into separating that divide of understanding?
I think that varies greatly from one area to another. It depends in part on the strength of existing relationships between those communities. I've had a project that was a very long-lasting, a large-scale one, where two participating entities at the beginning just hated each other's guts. And that made the early stages of that project very, very difficult. They did it because they had an external driver, which was the federal government, saying you need to do the following, it's a compliance order. And eventually they got to a very harmonious relationship. But the early days of it were difficult because they didn't have a mutual trust to begin with. I've been in other places where there are existing relationships across entities already because staff have moved from one to the other or have done something else together. There are relationships, and that dialogue becomes quite, you know, starting the dialogue becomes quite easy. And so I guess I would say a lot of this is actually relationship driven because it requires mutual trust. If you walk in there playing poker, it doesn't go well. People have to be willing to put their cards on the table.
I want to be careful that those that are with us today here in person don't see this as a diatribe on challenges. The challenges are out there, but the challenges are what excite me, the opportunity. What can we do and be better? I'll give you an example. So the C51 project that you heard about a while ago was one that I was intimately involved with. And in the case of that project, there were a number of hurdles that had to be overcome. Some were technical, some were scientific. At the end of the day, some of them were political too, but it spurned a notion in me that there's an opportunity in that model. In that particular case, you had a private property owner who had a resource that they sat on that could be used for the betterment and for the benefit of communities in the Lower East Coast. And they managed to, over a long period of time, but they managed to cobble together a message about the opportunity, proved out technically that it was possible, and then got buy-in from the water management district and the state to implement it. But what was unique about that project, if you stop to think about it, is you have an entity, in this case a private sector entity, that is supported by interlocal agreements with the local governments that are participating, that are developing a water resource, and then that water resource is proportioned to each of the participants based upon how much water they're getting out of that project. And so as we talk about One Water initiatives, whether they be in Florida or anywhere else, the part that to me is exciting is, okay, that's not the way we've traditionally done business in Florida. I can't think of another example where the private sector entity built a water supply project and then sold is the wrong word because we don't sell water here in Florida, but apportioned the cost proportionately to those that participated in the project. And it made me think, when I was at the Water Management District, I remember having long conversations with Carol Wheely, who was the executive director at the time, is why is this not more common? Why can't, if your Water Management District can be responsible for and build a $3 billion stormwater treatment area, why can't you go to an area of the state where you know that there's a regional need for water supply and develop a single water supply, a project, and then have local governments participate in its benefit through a proportionate share of the costs? Again, out of the box thinking, one of the things that I think we're invited to do is, and Lynn and I were talking a little bit about this before the panel started, in 2022 I fought long and hard, because those of you who know me know that for 15 years I've been whining about water funding in Florida. We'll cover that at some point in the talk today. But it hit me that that was the 50th year of Florida's water laws, the 1972 famous water laws that we've operated under. And it really caused me to think about whether or not the paradigms that were in place then are still true today. It has served us, but are there any changes that we can make to the system that would make it more efficient and allow us to implement larger visions like the type of projects that you're trying to get off the ground here in Winter Haven? And I have to believe that the answer is yes. The question is, how do we package that, again, so that we can get the support of the local governments, get the support of the community, ultimately get the support of the state, and in some cases the federal government, to participate and support the project? I think we can do it, but that's the challenge. And I think it can be done.
Is part of that a result of you have a place like the Everglades, which gets a lot of attention, gets a lot of money, and how many Everglades can you have at one time? And so how many of these things can you do at once? You yourself worked on the Regional Water Cooperative, Heartland Alliance, all these things put together. Is there a lack of creativity in terms of how many things we can do at once? You look at now you have the Indian River Lagoon and you have the Everglades, but it's like, we're looking at CFWI and over here. We'll get to the money part later, but it's just the matter of attention. And is it easier to think in those terms when you talk about the Everglades which was the subject of decades of magazine articles and newspapers and famous people that got involved. Like, who are our famous people, you know, for CFWI? Who are the famous people for, you know, the West Central areas where you're dealing with, you know, the more western end of the Sequoia?
So the Everglades is an anomaly in with regard to how long the state of Florida has been engaged in the restoration of it. We all understand how high profile those projects are. But to me, one of the things that I commonly say to folks that I work with is, you don't need to invent another wheel, you just need to have one of your own. So in their case, they've managed to raise public awareness to a point that you can't run for public office in the state of Florida without proclaiming on a stack of Bibles that you will do good by the Everglades. I have to believe that the people in this part of the state have similar challenges that, and that's our problem collectively. We fail if we don't get our communities to make it clear to our leaders, our legislative leaders, our congressional leaders locally, that what's happening in their backyard matters. You know, one of the projects that, you know, I've been working hard on with Tabitha and some of the other folks in the room is, here's a perfect example. How many of you are aware that approximately 3 years ago, the property upon which the headwaters of the Peace River sit was acquired? And that there's, I see one hand, and that there's a project that is being developed by Polk County in partnership with a private company here in Florida to restore the headwaters of the river, where the Saddle Creek and the Peace Creek come together to form the Peace River. That very parcel of land, which is part of your system, is one of those projects. Has anybody heard of it? I mean, one of the most iconic rivers in this state. And there are people who are working to try to put together a plan to restore it, a river that affects many other folks downstream, and nobody's heard about it. And what I continue to argue is like all of the challenges that we have and that we're facing here, here's the challenge that I'll leave you with, that is important. The people who are selling this cannot be the public sector. I've worked in the legislative process too long to know that whatever they ask for the most part, falls on deaf ears in Tallahassee. You've got your own funding source, you fix your problem, you deal with it. When the private sector organizes and goes to them and says, no, this is important, because these projects mean work in our community. These projects are not just good for the environment or good for the community, it also means jobs. Then they begin to listen. The only reason why, and I don't want to short circuit to the money part, but later you'll hear, the main reason why the transportation budget of the state of Florida is around $15 billion a year, and the water budget is short of $3 billion a year, is because the transportation sector, like the Everglades, has a long, well-worn path of support from the private sector. The ones that drive investment in infrastructure is not towns and cities throughout the state. It's the contractors associations that are getting that work, that are super well organized and make sure that funding for transportation is never cut. The minute the state starts cutting back on the budget, transportation is one of the last things to get cut. Water, one of the first. Why? Because there's no clear advocacy for it. We're not organized that way. And so that's the opportunity that I think for individual projects we need to do a better job of.
Let's then go forward. We'll mix that in then, you know, at this point. We'll talk about the money, but at the same time, talk about the break in that messaging. And I don't want to, you know, bogart the entire panel with you and me having the same discussion we've had for a decade and a half now. But you're the one that's represented local governments in Tallahassee. You represent a water management district in Tallahassee. You've spent most of your career now was spent in Tallahassee. These things, and the Everglades seems a lot easier to explain. You show a picture and it's these places and there's some birds and aren't the birds great? And we saw an alligator. It's like, what do you have? Like, you have one gorgeous project with the sapphire necklace, but the thing that you're talking about is much, much, it's another Everglades. Any River Lagoon is another Everglades. And so, The solutions are a little more complicated than simply how do we move more water south and how do we clean it, you know, before it moves south, you know, into those areas. It's you're dealing with a lot more groundwater. It's, you know, it's hugely complex. You've got springs where you don't have that in South Florida. And so where does that breakdown in communication come from, where, you know, the lens of the world are saying, it's like, look, you wrote some laws, and these aren't bureaucrats at DEP or Water Management District. These are laws that are written to fix a problem that makes total sense to think about, if you think about it as one thing rather than as many things, which is, I think, the point. Why is that breaking down? Why is that messaging breaking down?
So I'll try to go first. So if you think about it just from the information that we have at hand, I think the state is amazing with our water management districts laying out information about all of the water resource concerns in each area that they look at, right? So we have all this information. Here's the counties we take care of, here's all the water resource concerns, here's what we need to do. We have all these models throughout our state. So we totally think of our state as South Florida, Central Florida, and North Florida, and we're just Florida. We have the information of our state right now to say, where are all wetlands? What are the challenges? Holistically as a state, what do we need to be careful of? But then once you put that down and you have 150 different municipalities looking at territory, not water, territory, it starts to get more complicated. So I think we have everything we need right now. It's what we don't have is the mindset to move forward, and it's breaking past the territories along the way to do that, because we should be able to right now as a state say, okay, if we're gonna double our population, here's our challenges between North Florida to South Florida, and this is how we have to change our comprehensive plans, this is how we have to change our regulations. So we have all of that, but why aren't we doing it?
Well, let me ask you then, from that regional water supply planning perspective, from the CFWI as an implementer of law in that regard, is it not the right tool? Are we not being specific enough? Are we not looking longitudinally enough? Where does that information break happen? Is it because we don't understand each other, the language that we're speaking?
All of the above, I think. So I think we have the technical information, right, Frank? Would you say that? And David, we have all the, there's nothing missing, no data gaps missing, right? So is the breakdown between our local municipalities, or is it with our elected officials? Is it just purely territory? This is my space and my water? I don't know.
I think we have a regulatory structure and an institutional structure that's the product of our history. When we started off with development in Florida, you know, one of the early concerns was flood control. A lot of the state is pretty wet, and if you want to build on it, you want to dry it out. So we started off with the water management districts are divided up on surface water lines. That doesn't suit us particularly well for groundwater, which goes straight across those lines, so you get inconsistencies of management philosophy on each side. Institutions develop a culture and perspective of their own, and getting to consistent application of state law through rule within the water management districts is hard. CFWI was supposed to achieve that. It didn't. What we achieved was one model, one groundwater model. It's still being applied completely differently by three different water management districts in their water use permitting rules. They didn't change that. They just changed the tool. But the outcomes are driven by the rules and the way they apply the tool. But in general, all of our structure for dealing with water is an evolutionary process. We keep adding pieces on as we see a problem that becomes sufficiently big that we have to fix it. And what we're facing now is we have this structure that was designed for the problems we faced back then. Our problems now are different in character. We back then you could deal with everything at an individual level. The crossover effects were small enough that neglecting them didn't matter. That's no longer true. We need to deal with the interlinkages, and we have a structure that doesn't particularly encourage that. You heard me earlier asking Adam about how do you evaluate for funding purposes, all these different potential benefits and costs of different projects in different areas in order to rank them. It's an extremely difficult problem to do that equitably and rigorously. We have a permitting structure that is largely prohibitive. It doesn't focus on what's the good you could do. It focuses on don't do the following bad things. And so we move into a thing where you're not allowed to degrade a minimum flows in an MFL lake, for instance, on water levels. You might find your water use permit is constrained by half a dozen of them. You get into a position of going, you know what? Relatively easily, I could fix three of these with mitigation projects, but that one over there is a real problem. If I fix these three, is it okay to make that one a little bit worse? No, it's not. By rule, you may not make anything that's non-compliant worse. It doesn't matter, it doesn't count for anything that these three over here have been fixed. 0 points for that. And so the incentive structure, at least in the permit world, doesn't actually encourage good behavior. It focuses solely on preventing some form of defined bad behavior. And one of the things that drives us towards is an environmental equivalent of urban sprawl. If you're not allowed to adversely affect certain things that are close to you, the solution is, in part, you move your demands further away. And since those ones haven't been brought down to minimum standards yet in that area, you're allowed to take water from there. So then we bring them down also to minimum standards, and we propagate that area of degraded quality away from our cities. Is that philosophically the right thing to do? Would we be better off accepting that urbanization in general is pretty bad for environmental water features, wetlands in particular, but also the lakes that are surrounded by cities? Their habitat value is substantially less than those that are in more pristine environments. Does it actually make more sense to say, I'll accept more damage in this area where things are already fairly degraded, if in return for that, I can preserve the more natural habitats that have a complete ecosystem around them? I don't say one is definitely worse than the other, but there's a choice there, and I'm not sure that we've even thought our way through, did the choice we made before still apply as the best policy today?
All right, let's take a minute to talk about my friends at Sea and Shoreline. When I say the names Andrew, Ian, Irma, and Michael, what immediately enters your mind? If you answered hurricanes, congratulations, you're a Floridian. We all know that hurricanes bring devastating wind, rain, and storm surge. What you may not already know is that my friends at Sea and Shoreline are the leading innovators in the quest to mitigate the destructive wave energy of storm surges with their patented wave attenuation devices, or WADs. Not only can WADs protect against the effects of storm surge, they can also protect our beaches and shorelines from the massive erosion events that tropical storms and hurricanes bring. In fact, WADs have been shown to increase shoreline accretion. That's right. Their technology can help build shorelines. Sea and Shoreline is committed to protecting and preserving Florida's communities and coastlines because they are Floridians, and these are their communities too. To find out how you can partner with Sea and Shoreline to protect your community, visit them at www.seaandshoreline.com. You'll be glad you did.
Frank, because I want you to address something specifically. It's like in that regard, you're a Tallahassee guy. You've been a part of writing a bunch of laws. That's the toolbox you have, is statute. Is the creation of statute too turgid of an entity to do that? I mean, because there is no flexibility written into it. So how do you develop some sort of flexibility that may make that sense, that someone may want to do for the greater benefit there?
I'll go back to the point I made the first time I spoke. It's leadership. I think, unfortunately, we live in an environment where I don't think true creativity of thought is encouraged. It is in the private sector, because all of the folks that work in the private sector have to figure out a better way to build the mousetrap, so the next time that they respond to an RFP and go before oral presentations, they can show the prospective client something innovative that may save costs that will get them the job. But as institutions that govern water in Florida, I don't think we promote creative thought. I don't think we promote the kind of forward thinking that David was just alluding to. And then that makes its way into the halls of Tallahassee, because when we propose a law that pushes that boundary, immediately the first hurdle that we get to, and Adam, go like this, it's not Adam Blaylock, but the department is the first entity that they go to. And if the department isn't on board with your new creative concept, you're dead in the water. And then if it isn't the department, it's the water management districts. And so, and I believe that those institutions are filled with enormously talented individuals, but individuals who realize that they have to operate within a political construct that does not reward creativity for the most part, that is just get the job done. And get the job done in a way that doesn't create negative press for those that are in charge. And so this is why we've had instances in the past, and for those who are listening and those here this comment is not intended at the DeSantis administration. We have had administrations in the past that when there has been a blatant need for additional funding support to do research and development, for example, of the work that Lynn's been working on, Reclaim Water, you know, you get a drip. And when you go to the policy, the folks, your counterparts inside the agency, and you go, come on now, you need a lot more money. We've been told that we have all the money we need. That's the public line. We are not to ask for more money. We have all the money that we need. And so, again, I think somehow we need to figure out a way to, and I think they're out there, I really do. I've met with enough elected officials that I believe that they're out there. People who can break through that and ignite that creativity, ignite the thinking about the possibility to then pursue both policy, regulatory reform, innovation, and funding to implement the projects. And to your point, you know, I'll give you a perfect example of where I faced that. My career is so bloody long. When I worked in Miami-Dade County, I was responsible for developing the wetland regulation laws of the state. And one of the things that we had to do was find offsite mitigation areas. A lot of people here may or may not know, the first wetland mitigation bank that was ever permitted in the state of Florida, the first private bank was in Broward County, but the first true bank was in the Hole in the Donut in Everglades National Park. You cannot begin to believe the institutional pushback that we got at the notion of taking tractors and trailers to convert 6,000 acres of Brazilian pepper, former farmland, through the mid-70s and convert it into a wetland. All of the research scientists at the Dan Beard Center in Everglades National Park, a Declaration of Independence-like letters with dozens of signatures objecting to how dare we go into a national park and bring tractors and trailers and move earth inside a national park. Today it's a showcase. Today the national park boasts about this incredible restoration project that took place. Thank God we had the leaders and the superintendent at the time and others up the chain in the Department of Interior that said, yeah, there's an element of risk here, but it's for the better good. And we got the project done. But that kind of innovative and big thinking is what I find is most challenging to find in our environment here in Florida.
All right, keep doing it, Frank. So we're gonna talk about money. Let's just get right into it. Like, first there's the part of, I want you to give the big gap of before, but then I want to make sure we follow that with what are our responsibilities at a regional and local level to do our part. And I know that both Lynn and David have some ideas regarding that, and it has to do with the regulatory side of things and how you approach it, and whether or not you have tools that you're given to deal with the demand management side of the equation as well. And so have at it for a minute, and then I want to talk about what are our responsibilities as we're having these conversations, you know, in Tallahassee ought to sound like.
Okay. So I apologize to those of you who've heard this spiel many times at many conferences. Florida has a money problem. We have a serious, serious, serious money problem. And I believe the time has come for our elected officials at all levels of government to acknowledge it and attempt to do something about it. What do I mean by that? The state of Florida's budget currently is in the $115 billion range. And I'll dispense with the drama that I do with when I give speeches and I ask people hands up how many people think what percentage of the budget. The state of Florida over the last 16 years on average has spent about 0.8% of the state budget on water. 0.8%. By contrast, we spend about 11% of the state budget on transportation. And the question that I ask folks at the Association of Counties and the League of Cities when I talk to the local leaders, is that a reflection of our values? Is water so unimportant that we spend one order of magnitude less on water, all things water, by the way, water supply, flood control, everything, than we do on transportation. Everybody goes, oh my God, I didn't realize the number was that small. And no, that's not a reflection of our values. Well, if it's not a reflection of our values, then why aren't we doing something about it? And what we did about that was a group of us, and some of them are in the audience, in 2016, we said, you know what, the legislature's never gonna listen to us. If I bring a number to the legislature, they're gonna go, yeah, whatever. Why don't we get their own auditing arm, the folks that give them advice on money, to do a report and document how much the state of Florida needs for water infrastructure. And so we passed a bill, and the Office of Economic Demographics and Research, EDR, if you want to look it up, it makes for good reading, generates a report every year, an annual assessment, on the state's land management goals and needs and on water. And the running total as of the 2024 edition, and it's interesting because after the second edition, they stopped publishing a single number. Now you have to dive into the report and find from the different sections their estimates, but all the data's there. Their data, they say that by 2020, in the next 20 years, the state of Florida is gonna need to invest $227 billion in water infrastructure in the state. That number does not include any investment adaptation for coastal sea level rise. None. So stop to think about it, right? The Back Bay project that is being evaluated by Miami-Dade County to provide flood control to Miami-Dade County, South Miami-Dade County, is $5 billion is the last estimate that I thought. So projects like that aren't even part of that equation. $227 billion. How much does Florida spend on water? We are doing record spending. The DeSantis administration has pushed us far beyond any administration before. We're not up to $3 billion. We're getting close, but we're not up to $3 billion a year in state funding support. Well, you do the math. 20 years of $3 billion is $60 billion, and our need is $227 billion and counting. Folks, we've got a crisis. And if we don't, if we cannot successfully, as public and private sector professionals in the water environment, bring this to a boil so that the legislature does something about it, we're not gonna get to where we need to go. You can make all the plans you want, you can have all the pretty projects that you want, you're not gonna get the money for it. Without money, what's the point? I believe, having talked to enough legislative leaders, every time that I've met with the leadership group, three running and two into the future, and every time that we talk about this, they're like, we need to figure something out. But at the end of the day, we have a hurricane and we don't do anything about it. But that's the challenge.
So you've been told that, what I've been told when I take that up to Tallahassee is, it's our local government's fault.
They don't talk about fault, the legislators.
No, they've actually said that. It has to be handled at the local government, that our rates are not high enough. So, but when you seriously think about that, and this is the stuff that does keep me up at night. I don't know why, but it does. Just a small municipality, and my municipality is we're under 45,000 right now. We have to expand our wastewater plant. That's about at least minimum of 150 million. We need another water plant. That's, 25 million. I have to fix all of my water pipes and wastewater pipes. What do we got? At least 15 million. I think that was a 5 years ago number though. How do we do that on the backs of our ratepayers? I mean, how do we do that? I mean, it's just not, and then on top of it, I have to be innovative and figure out where I'm landlocked, where our next water supply is, because we're in between CFWI and Tampa Bay Water. So increasing my WUP is getting increasingly more difficult, so I have to have these innovative projects. I've become a master at begging for money, legislative appropriation grants. I mean, I feel like that's my second full-time job as a utility director, is begging for money. So I don't know how we do this. I mean, there's not an answer for it unless we do something really creative, Frank.
And that's the challenge, right? I think the issue's not how, it's that we have to. When I've sat with legislative leaders and I've sat with local government officials in the hundreds in the audience, it's a bit melodramatic, but what the heck, I say, this is your Flint, Michigan moment. 10 years from now, 20 years from now, when we have massive water problems in the state that we can't fix in short order, certainly in the time that we're going to need to fix them, you can't sit here. Nobody who's sitting in this audience right now can say, oh, I didn't know the problem didn't exist. Oh, I never knew that. I've told you that the problem exists. I've told you what the source is to find the information to confirm that it exists. And it isn't me telling you. It's the it's the government's own reports that say this is what we need. Well, if the reports say that, why can't we get the legislative leadership to do something about it? And what you will find, Lynn, is, in fairness to them, is that $227 billion and counting number is all water, all local drinking water, all local wastewater, the orphans, as I call, of water resources. You know, every time that the state threatens to smack a local government with fines because it's not meeting a TMDL, my first question is, well, where's the money supposed to come from? There isn't rate collections to clean up water. So I think that creative minds can sit down together, apportion responsibility for a percentage of that cost, and come up with a meaningful plan for how to pay for all of these things that we want to do.
Can we address that part of the equation, which is, assume for our discussion that Lynn, the city of Plant City, is doing everything right. They're charging the right amount per 1,000 gallons for drinking water. They're charging the right amount for wastewater collection. They're charging all the right things. They're doing the right things. They're having the right regulations, which I'll talk about. I know that I think Lynn doesn't necessarily believe that that's the case, but that's where we get into. It's like this butting up against some people who would say are doing it, quote, finger right, or doing it right, and then some folks that they would look at. You always have these examples, and sometimes they're rather large examples in other parts of the state. I'm looking toward, say, the southeast part of the state, where there's more money, and it seems to be a less investment, at least historically, in some of these resources. And so when you look and you have these conversations with legislators, do we have a responsibility, meaning we globally as local governments, communities, to make sure that what is that line that we're supposed to reach before we go and ask for $230 billion?
Certainly the local level of effort is not something that they're blind to, but I don't believe that is what's holding them back from acting. They're saying, oh, the local governments aren't doing enough. What's holding them back is a political philosophy of not raising fees and taxes. And as I've said, again, to rooms of leaders, China's not going to come in and build the infrastructure for us. We're going to have to build it, and we're going to have to pay for it. And so the question, and just so that for transparency purposes, the great idea that I have floated for many years, I've worked with countless folks to look at different ways to raise funds. And at the end of the day, the conclusion that I came to in my last couple of years of professional life in Florida was, it doesn't make sense to try to cobble together. Some people say, well, look at a tax on bottled water, look at a tax on water, look at, you know, any of a number of different solutions. And all of them raise fractions of what's needed and require enormous amounts of political energy and fortitude to implement. The one idea that I have been pitching to the legislative leadership, which requires less bravery, is why don't you let the citizens of Florida speak? Why don't we bring a question to the citizens of Florida as to whether or not they would support a penny sales tax on all goods in the state, not just water, everything, all of which would go to water. The numbers associated with such a proposal is that under current economy, it would raise between $7 and $8 billion a year. Couple that with the near $3 billion that we're already spending, it puts us in the $10 billion a year area for water infrastructure investment. That's rather significant. And it would be solely at the discretion of the voters of the, and about a third of that would be paid by visitors to the state. There's no other funding source that you can identify in Florida where others are going to pay a significant portion of it. And so what I've told the Republican leadership, which is for the most part very anxious about putting new taxes and fees, is I'm not asking you to put in a tax or a fee. I'm asking you to give the citizens of the state of Florida the opportunity to make a decision for themselves. So could you please put the question on the ballot? Now, That kind of momentum would be greatly supported if the private sector stepped up to the plate big time and almost made a demand of the of bringing arguments of job and economic growth, which are ones that they can relate to the table. I mean, the reason why this panel, I think, was structured this way is because, as you can tell, I talk too much and I'm the advocate. David is the one, is a person who builds projects for public sector entities, and Lynn is a leader in our public sector community in the state in trying to promote these ideas. And so collectively, how can we cobble a message together that other people will carry on from here?
Yes, but let's talk about the step just before that, because you still have two questions in my mind that you have to address before you get to that point of address. And I know you're already having these conversations. They've been going on for a number of years now, I think large part, you know, because of your involvement. One is, what happens if you don't spend $226 billion in 10 years? And then secondly, we're still circling back to the same question before, which is, let's say they said we're in on your $7-8 million a year. Well, that's a third of that need as expressed in the EDR report. Where does the remainder of that 22 plus billion dollars a year of need come from, and how do they do it either from the demand management side or from the revenue creation side? Because I think you're right, it's like the more you do it, the less places there are to hide. And so that's what I want, if you can, to some extent, Lynn and David, I want you to talk a little bit about that.
So Frank, shut up is what you're saying. Okay, that's right, go ahead.
You know me so well.
If we don't do it, I think we're gonna quickly see the results of it in failures. If we don't repair our infrastructure, we're gonna see breaks that are incredibly costly. We're gonna see sanitary sewer overflows. We'll eventually get the message. I think what Frank is talking about is being proactive. And I think what typically happens instead is that, you know, the poop hits the fan completely, and then we have to do something about it. So maybe I'm hoping that we don't have to get to the point of failures. But add on top of it, besides all these things that we have to do and the money that, frankly, I think this is a brilliant idea because it's such a shared cost. It's not just shared amongst everybody in our state, but the tourists that come into our state and use our resources. So it's a fantastic idea. But I think we're going to start seeing the stressors of, here's what's going to happen if you don't put the money in, and then it'll be more costly, but eventually we'll do it.
How does that show up in the center part of the state? We know how it shows up in Southeast Florida. Speaking from that East Hillsborough County, Polk County, you know, into CFW, how does that manifest?
Well, we're already seeing part of CFWI is over pumping. So, I mean, if we're not taking care of everything, we're gonna see it all the way around. Besides failing infrastructure, we're not gonna do growth properly if we're not spending this money. And then we're gonna get to the point of moratoriums. We're already seeing that in Central Florida. I think we'll come to a place where we're failing and we can't grow. And then we'll say, you know, we need some money, how about a tax?
Yeah, I unfortunately see a similar endpoint there. The place that we've put ourselves in now with existing regulations is that many communities are going to find that the CFWI 2025 rule is going to start binding on them to actually reduce pumping from the Upper Floridan Aquifer. It takes a long time to develop alternative water supplies that are different than that. And if you don't get sufficiently far ahead of the curve, and I would say most communities already are not, sufficiently far ahead of that curve, you get to a point where, okay, you're facing a growth moratorium because you're overpumping, you have to reduce your pumpage, very the least not continue increasing it, which means you stop growth. As soon as you stop growth, you'll have the political pressure to get money.
Well, let me ask that, because I think we keep talking about the thing that happens to us from a governmental standpoint, and rather from why does somebody who lives one of the 750,000 people that live in Polk County, for example, right now, why would they care about your moratorium? Somebody is like, close the door behind you. We live it as part of being Floridians, is you got here, it's like, hey, I'm great. And everyone else behind me is like, no, thank you. The CFWI was not created as a means of limiting growth. It was a means of preventing some resource impact that has a tangible impact on these ecosystems, this environment. What is that impact? Because is that not the thing that sells people that? It's like, it's not some unnamed person that may show up 5 years from now is not going to get to come. It's going to be this place that you as a kid, a spring, a lake, you know, a river, what have you, is dry or otherwise impacted from a water quality standpoint, right?
I think there's a fraction of our population that does see the world that way. But the question is, does that fraction have political influence to really move the kind of money that we're talking about here at political level in Tallahassee? I would suggest not. The primary economic drivers in this state, I believe, are still agriculture and development. And so once development gets threatened, that will reverberate through the halls of power. The challenge that I see is the collision that's coming, because we already have regulations in place that constrain us, but we don't yet have an adequate supply of solutions nor the funding to implement them. And unfortunately, you know, that usually results in people who are at mid-level getting fired for, why didn't you fix this problem? It's given me a political problem now. Directors of utilities and so on, and their consultants all get the chop, and you bring new people in and start doing what you should have done 5 years ago but couldn't because the funding wasn't available. There are some things, I think, as a state that we could be doing that would buy us time. I've heard several people already today talk about the amount of water we squander on irrigation. Your typical utility is spending 40 to 50% of its water going to irrigation. That is a non-essential function. Very much driven by our choices of landscaping, and in particular of planting inappropriate exotic species in landscaping. And my number one target, yes, St. Augustine, we're talking about you. If we simply said, we're not irrigating St. Augustine grass in this state, you would buy a decade or more of time to get the other grander solutions here in terms of being able to make our existing infrastructure go further in service of other types of water use.
Is there something to add to that? Because I want to get to the math of what that means. That when we say we irrigate X percentage, you know, on grass, and I want to know, it's like, are we taking the steps? You know, speaking of a one water commission, are we taking the steps necessary to present that data to someone and saying, this is how much it costs for Lynn to produce X amount of gallons of water to put on a grass, completely unnecessary. I mean, there are lots of other grasses that are much more drought tolerant, look better, in my opinion, easier on the feet, that sort of thing, but we're not doing it.
So I'll just tell you a little short story and how that, it sounds like that should make sense and everybody should resonate with it. But when I was on the consulting side in Hernando County, we tried to change the landscape code to not allow St. Augustine. We just thought this was gonna be a simple thing. We got to the commission meeting and it was literally standing room only. We didn't know why. We were stupid enough not to understand it was for us. I mean, every home builder, developer was there to tell us that we were trying to kill them.
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah, by stopping their sales with their St. Augustine grass that everybody expects to see when they come down here. So it was unanimously thrown out. I mean, they wouldn't even hear us. So yeah, it doesn't work.
I had a similar experience about 15 years ago speaking to a developers conference and basically made the same pitch. Guys, quit planting this stuff. You do something else. And because otherwise, you're going to get to a point, your concern is you can't sell property. If we get to a point where we don't have enough water to supply your future properties, you won't be able to sell property. You have a vested interest in this. Total silence, not a single response, just this flat stare of who brought this guy here? Get off the stage. So I think it has to be that you'll get support from that side when they see their own economic interests threatened by our inability to provide enough water. That's when I think there will be a meeting of the minds to say, oh, there really is a shared issue here. We all need to back this. But I think until you get there and get that recognition as being it's not a fairy story we're telling you, it's for real. I think you have to get to that point before you'll be able to get the consensus personally.
When you look at these places, I grew up in East Central, Hillsborough, and not as much. I was in the part of Sefner that didn't have so much St. Augustine grass, put it that way. But I understand why people want to have nice lawns. I mean, it's certainly within the realm of of reason. However, the disconnect for me is not understanding. Is it almost like, are these guys Teamsters or something, the St. Augustine guys? Or, you know, like, what is it that you can't choose, a builder can't choose something else that makes more sense? Frank, you talk about thinking creatively. Give me the creative solution, the creative conversation surrounding St. Augustine or, you know, these other types of grass that makes sense. I mean, put the target on you for a minute.
Before I answer your question, I don't want to leave an issue unaddressed. You said, okay, if you get your penny sales tax, you're still short on funding. The numbers that you promulgate, almost $3 billion a year number that I gave, is strictly the state of Florida's investment. It does not include the water management districts. A lot of people would be interested to know that the water management districts on their own generate about $1.1 billion. Their budgets are nearing $3 billion because of all of the pass-through funding from the state of Florida. But not included in that are local revenues. So when you add the revenues of utilities at the local and county level combined with the state investment, you would get to the entire funding formula. And then the last thing is, if you were really, really desperate, you know, one of the questions that we used to grapple with in the AWWA was, you know, all of the Western states get all of this money for water infrastructure. What about the East? Yes, there was once upon a time we had a lot of water, and water shortage clearly is what drove investment in Western water resource development. But the tide is turning, and maybe that should be revisited. But neither here nor there. With regard to the use of St. Augustine grass, I think one of the things that the water management districts have done right, God, that sounds like they do so much wrong. I think one of the good things that they've done is they have really stepped up and promoted conservation as a whole as part of growth in the state of Florida. And I know that there are stringent requirements upon builders, there are stringent requirements upon local governments to implement more and more water-conscious technologies and such. So I think that it's something that you don't snap a finger and that industry goes away. But I think that continued investment in water conservation, the implementation of water conservation programs throughout the state, may ultimately lead to the goal, which is to use less water, make more available for essential uses. Did I sidestep that good enough?
Yeah, you literally didn't answer that question. I think to the point about the conservation part, and I was like feverishly writing and talking to Lynn and David, has been a huge part of that. I'm constantly writing, like, oh, I can't wait to say that with only so much time to get to. It's like, but I do want to talk about that because it's also something that Keely Carlton brought up from Seminole County earlier, which has to do with purple pipes. When I was coming up, and you remember those days of the, you know, youngster still back then, you know, talking about the end all be all was purple pipes. You take water from a wastewater plant, you treat the heck out of it, and it's super duper expensive, but it's great because we're going to go and you'll send it to golf courses or people's homes, and that's the, you know, that's much better than what we're doing, which is a giant waste. As it turns out, maybe that's not the best way to approach it, and sometimes it's perverse, you know, incentive for watering more. And so I'm interested in, like, how big of a piece is it to fundamentally changed the way we think about the conservation of water from the old way that we thought about 20 years ago.
So I'll start by saying that purple pipe was really necessary evil to get us out of the completely thinking of our water as effluent to actually even considering that it's actually a beneficial resource. When you think about it from a private point of view, it's this renewable resource that we have we're giving away. So we're treating it at $10 to $15 a gallon, and then we are repumping it at a high price down a third set of pipes at a high price and giving it away for pennies on the dollar. It's a terrible idea. And then on top of it, that it gives the illusion that there's a whole bunch of water for a whole bunch of irrigation for a whole bunch of zone 11 plants that you shouldn't have in Central Florida. So it's just, it propagates so many bad things. And now I'll use the word littered with purple pipe, and we have to figure out this equation. It's just another thing we have to try to figure out. So I've fought it tooth and nail in Plant City, right, Murph? I was been forced to put it in places. And I've tried to explain it to my city manager that just what a bad return on investment this is. And he truly believes that if you're going to irrigate a lawn, there's just no reason to irrigate it with potable water when you could be using that water that comes in the purple pipes. So it's taken a long time to get the point across to him that this is not a great investment and we should diversify our resources, because when it rains, what are you going to do with all that supply anyway? So purple pipe is, it again, I think it was necessary for us to say, stop thinking of it as effluent. We didn't have the room for rapid infiltration basins across our state anyway, right? So we got it to the next step. I just don't know how we unravel ourselves from this, and I'm glad there's not that many people here who hear me say that. Whoa, this is recorded.
Sudden realization. Yeah, I have quite a long time sort of fought the obsession with purple pipe projects, because I didn't see them as cost effective or as optimal use of the available resource. It's an example actually of where public messaging has been very successful. The public has absorbed that message. We actually, I think, especially need state agencies now to help us undo that message and say, all right, there are better ways to do this now, and that these are beneficial, and don't automatically think of purple pipe as your preferred solution. Because that message has got thoroughly embedded. The good news is we've moved away from the fear of reclaimed water as a somehow toxic and dangerous substance. We're beginning to move into, I think, a rising level of acceptance of the idea of total water recycling to reuse. There's still going to be some resistance there, I believe, but it is diminishing as other people in the world do it, and we can see those projects being successful. But yeah, as I said earlier, all these things ultimately are evolutionary, and as we figure out better ways of doing things, sometimes we're caught with the history of what already got us here, and I have to undo some of that.
Which I think at the end of the day is what brings us to the one water concept. It's being able to look at all issues associated with the management of that resource cohesively, and spinning a web or developing a story that addresses the needs of the community, addresses the needs of the environment collectively. It's not to, you know, throw stones at people who had very good intentions and implemented ideas in the past, but this notion that there have to be trade-offs. In some instances, that's true, but in many instances, you don't have to have trade-offs. You can have growth and still safeguard water quality. You can still do water supply development in a responsible way that doesn't, you know, completely undermine the protection of certain water resources. That's the key. So the key to me is moving forward in a bigger context, and most of all, communicating that idea and its importance to the key policymakers and the public.
All right, I think we're actually coming close to our time. I want to ask two questions. Frank, you don't get one of them. The first one I'll ask of David, and it's one of the questions I put on all of my podcasts. I do kind of a standard number of questions, and so I'll ask you: are you optimistic about the future, the environment, and natural resources in Florida? And whichever way, I want to know why.
Optimistic? No. But neither am I in the depths of pessimism. I think there is a valid path forward. I think, particularly in the short term, it'll be a painful one. We face some drivers that the state can't do anything about, and rising sea levels is one of those things. That's simply a bigger problem than the state can deal with by itself. We have to just respond to it. There are things that fall more within our power. One that's sort of on the borderline, perhaps, is drainage wells. A great untapped resource is stormwater. Our stormwater regulations still, to this day, concentrate on controlling peak discharge. They don't control total discharge, the total volume that comes off the land. As you urbanize, that number goes up. Our stormwater regulations say, hold back enough so that the peak rate doesn't increase, but it discharges the same amount now for longer. The net effect on the rivers is increased discharge, not only in the average but in the peak, because different places are discharging. When in the old days, when one was receding, another was coming up, and now they're overlapping both at peak discharge, and so the receiving water body receives that. So the rivers see it as an increased problem of high floodwaters and scour and nutrient loading. And if we could find a way to divert and hold back that water so that we more closely match the historical hydrograph, it would be good for our natural systems, and it would provide water to use as a water supply. The problem is that it requires truly massive amounts of storage to do that. The one place that I can think of that can be done reasonably cost-effectively is in the aquifer. We've had a 60 to 80 year experiment in effect in the Orlando area, some 400 drainage wells. We also have water supply well fields in the area. We've not had a problem with water quality in the aquifer. The aquifer is able to handle a certain amount of stormwater recharge going in, and it will be treated by the aquifer system. Our regulations don't permit it. It's on the borderline of state control versus national control, because ultimately EPA injection rules apply here, and we have to get the injection rules are nationwide and sort of one size fits all. We sort of have a special condition, and if we could get some relaxation for allow this in Florida, I believe that could really solve some things, because otherwise we don't have another way to really cost effectively capture and use stormwater as part of our supply portfolio, and by not doing so we're exacerbating problems in other areas.
Congratulations, that was the most robust lightning round response I've gotten.
Sorry.
Lynn, I want to ask you, but Frank, you're going to get a question. Lynn, David covered optimism, pessimism, and everywhere in between. So I want to stick with this one question for you, which is, what professional accomplishment, in the midst of the challenges, what professional accomplishment are you most proud of?
So I'm going to say the work that I'm doing in Plant City, because it's really a team effort, not just me. I think we're an incredibly progressive utility. I'm hoping to show that we can be an example of how to get some of the things right in our world. So I would say the work I'm doing at Plant City.
And Frank, what advice would you give to young people who are just entering or have interest in entering the environmental field, and whether it's public service, you know, like we've done in the past, like Lynn is doing now, or the private sector like Dave?
I would say to a young person, welcome. I mean, this is going to be one of the most creative fields to work in for a very, very long time, with endless amounts of opportunity. And I think the take-home message, despite all of the negatives that perhaps we pointed out during the course of the podcast today, I still think that there's a world of opportunity out there. There's a lot of people out there who can make important things happen, and our job is to work collectively to doing that. And I think every one of us, virtually everybody in this room, can probably look back at something that you've done in the environment, a project that you can point to say, I had a hand in doing that. That's enormously rewarding. And I don't know anywhere else that you can get that feeling of truly doing something that changes the environment for the better.
Thanks for that note, Frank. And I think that's where we're stopping. Lynn Spivey, David McIntyre, Frank Bernardino, thanks so much for coming on the show. And thanks to the One Water Commission, Gary Hubbard, and Eric Draper for putting this together. Thanks.
And that's it for this episode. Again, make sure you visit us at thefloridaspecifier.com to see other great ways to learn about what's going on in the world of the environment in Florida. Until then, for my co-host Ryan Matthews, this is Brett Seifer saying thanks, and we'll talk to you next time.